From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. As COVID-19 cases surge around the country, driven by the Omicron variant, we do have some good news. Two new drugs have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration, both shown to reduce serious illness, hospitalization, and death among high-risk patients. So what's the difference between these pills, and what other treatments are available as we head into the gasp third year of the pandemic? Let's bring in Dr. Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan. Dr. Rasmussen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Celeste.
It's good to have you with us because I'm sure, like many people, I have a lot of questions. Yesterday's authorization for the Pfizer pill called Paxlovid shows it will be available to infected adults and kids 12 and older who have medical conditions. How significant is the approval of this drug?
Well, I think this really couldn't come a moment too soon. Now that we have the Omicron variant spreading widely throughout the U.S., that means that a lot of people, including people who are vaccinated, may potentially be coming down with severe COVID-19. So it's absolutely crucial that we have other options for treating those patients should they end up becoming severely ill due to the result of Omicron.
If people can get the pill, of course. We've read that the government has initially ordered enough pills for about 10 million people. And by one calculation, that would be enough to last a single day if half the people who've tested positive got it. Do you have high hopes for delivery to the patients that need it?
So that really is the downside to this, unfortunately. I don't know that we will have the supplies to be able to provide this pill as widely as would be desirable to all the people who are potentially at risk. Right now, we're looking at extremely steep case trajectories, meaning that we are seeing a lot of increasing cases in a very short period of time. And both of the drugs from Pfizer and Merck seem to work best when they're given very early after you identify that you have been infected. They have to be given within the first 5 days after diagnosis or symptom onset. Otherwise, they really don't work very well. So it's going to be really, really critical to find the patients that are the most at risk to make sure that they can get the limited supplies of these drugs. It also is going to be really, really important to make sure that people have access to testing so that they can be diagnosed as soon as possible. But it is a real problem that supplies will unfortunately lag on into the new year, and potentially we won't be able to provide this drug to all the people that need it until after the Omicron wave has passed.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's a lot of ifs there. Do they get a test? Do they get the test in time? Is the drug available? I wanted to ask you about today's authorization for Merck's drug, though. And I hope I pronounce this right. Molnupiravir. We're reading that it's
pretty
not
close.
As
I think it's molnupiravir.
Okay. We're reading it's not quite as effective as Paxlovid. France canceled its order for this drug after reading the data on it. What do you know about this one?
So there are a number of concerns about this drug, one of which is the fact that it, in the actual data that was submitted to the FDA, it was much less effective at reducing the risk of hospitalization compared to the interim and preliminary trial analysis that they did, which pegged it on par with the Paxlovid drug at about 90% risk reduction. In reality, it looks like it really doesn't work that well. That doesn't mean that it's completely useless. It does reduce the risk by a moderate amount. But there's another issue with this drug too, and that is that it really needs to be taken on the schedule that's provided, because it works by basically inducing so many mutations in the virus that the virus can no longer replicate or be functional. If you don't finish the course, or if you're taking doses of the drug that are not sufficient to kill off the virus, then you have the potential of generating potentially new mutants. And while in most cases, those mutants are not likely to result in new variants of concern because they would still have to undergo evolutionary selection, the possibility of potentially generating new mutants with a drug that doesn't even work that well is really cause for concern for a lot of people.
Earlier in the pandemic, there was a lot of talk about remdesivir. That drug was part of the treatment given to President Trump when he tested positive for COVID-19. Is that drug still in use, and is it considered to be effective?
So remdesivir is approved by the FDA. I think that the jury is out with remdesivir because it can be effective, and it has been shown to reduce the amount of time that people stay in the hospital, for example, but it doesn't provide a huge benefit in terms of reversing mortality. The other issue with remdesivir is that, like these other drugs, it needs to be given as soon as possible to people after they test positive. But unlike these drugs, which are delivered by pills, it's an IV infusion. So it's not as easy to just prophylactically give remdesivir to everybody who's diagnosed positive to make sure that that drug is going to work as effectively as it could.
Much easier to give them a pill if there's one available. What about antibody infusions? Many, especially those who are part of the long-haul community, say antibody infusions can help patients, some patients, avoid serious illness and those long-term COVID symptoms.
Yeah, so that's a great point. And really, any antiviral drug that can knock out an infection early is going to have major benefits for the potential of somebody to develop long-term symptoms. But the unfortunate thing with Omicron is that most of the monoclonal antibody treatments that are available for treating COVID-19 aren't likely to work against Omicron because they do target parts of the spike protein that are mutated in Omicron. So there's currently one monoclonal antibody that is expected to be effective. That's the Glaxo monoclonal antibody.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, supplies of that are extremely limited.
Virologist Angela Rasmussen at the University of Saskatchewan. Dr. Rasmussen, stay safe as always. Happy holidays and thank you.
Happy holidays and take care.
Well, federal student loan borrowers now have until May 1st to start paying back their loans. The president made that announcement this week, extending the original deadline of January 31st. Biden says so many Americans are still recovering from the economic impacts of the pandemic and just need a little more time before the payments start back up again. For more on this, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, welcome.
Thanks, Tanya. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to have you here. How many borrowers will this impact and how much of a difference will this deadline of May 1st make for them?
It'll make something of a difference. About 41 million borrowers are affected by this. 27 million of those borrowers have not been making their monthly payments since early 2020. Now, obviously, some of those borrowers have continued to work and have had an income and continue to make their payment. But the Education Department will be updating its guidance in a few days. The way it's worked in the past is that the payments will now not be due until May 1st, 2022. No payments will be due on government-held federal loans. So this doesn't apply to any private student loans. No interest will accrue on the government-held federal loans until the payments start again. No collection efforts will take place on any defaulted federal loans either. So it's a bit of a break. What it really indicates is that the administration, which had been resistant to extend this deadline, has been able to look at the situation and say, look, lots of people are still not working, so we need to push this out, which means it may get pushed out again. So it's not the biggest deal, but it's a big relief for people who thought they had a payment due on January 31st.
Well, I want to ask you about something else related. During his campaign, President Biden pledged that he would cancel a minimum of $10,000 for student borrowers. What has been the progress on that?
Well, nothing's happened so far, but the president has directed federal agencies to see whether he has the authority. That has to happen a lot these days because if you do something and you're not thought to have the authority for it, someone will sue. When asked earlier about it this month, Jen Psaki, the press secretary of the president, said that they're trying to review whether there's executive authority to do this, whether the president can do this himself, or whether this needs to be done through Congress. The president has indicated that he'd rather this be done congressionally. So I think that's where that discussion is right now. Everything kind of got stalled because of all the discussions around the Build Back Better bill. But the point is the president would like Congress to do this, but it has been a campaign promise of his, so all eyes are on the president.
You know, with the time I have left with you, Democratic lawmakers have also been pushing the president to cancel $50,000 in student debt, and others are just asking that he cancel student debt entirely. Is that still on the table?
Probably not. Biden has repeatedly resisted this. It was a big thing during the presidential campaign. A number of his opponents for the Democratic primary had suggested the idea of canceling $50,000 or all student debt. Biden's never really been in favor of that. And recently, during a town hall that was held on CNN, he has said pretty clearly he doesn't support the idea. Now, things change, but for the moment, the elimination of $50,000 or all student debt is not on the table.
Yep. And you kind of alluded to this, but when these payments do start back up in May, what could happen to those who suffer the most?
Well, there's some possibility of more extensions. Biden has said that he's not sure he can do that as president with executive action, but there should be some relief going to people based on their income at that point. So it's not a blanket suspension of payments, but it may be that people who at that point still do not have income or can't afford to make the payments can apply on a basis of their income to delay the payments.
That's Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. As always, thank you and happy holidays.
My pleasure. You too.
In Iceland, we have our own Santa Clauses. They are 13 brothers. They live in the mountains with their parents.
Before the pandemic, we were lucky to visit Iceland, where we heard a story we thought worth retelling. It's not, though, about Iceland's sibling Santa Clauses, who have names like Door Slammer and Candle Stealer, and who children try to placate by being good, so when they put their little shoes on the windowsill at night, they will get a gift and not a rotten potato. Or worse, a visit from the Santa's mom.
She would come to town and catch the naughty children. And when I was a kid, I knew that she would cook the kids for dinner.
Yes,
that's terrible. I was afraid of her. She died of starvation.
There you get a sense of Icelanders' dry humor and storytelling skills, maybe born of long, dark winter days with only a few hours of light, and their otherworldly landscape that inspired Tolkien and Jules Verne. It's easy to believe volcanic mountains might be home to ogre Santas or elves.
My name is Sigurbjörg Karlsdóttir, but everybody calls me Sippa, and we are now in the capital of the elves in Hafnarfjörður.
There, that's good.
Yes, elves. And Sippa is about to give us an elf tour. 54% of Icelanders believe in the so-called hidden people. And the rest?
They don't disbelieve in them.
Yeah. See, the thing is, they don't want to rule it out. I don't see them myself.
I was going to ask you, have you seen one?
No, well, I've only seen one in my dream. And it's not important whether you believe the elves are here or not. This is part of the culture. It's just part of life.
Well, we have a map that we are given on the tour. Beautiful little drawings. We'll have pictures at herenow.org. But things like elves like to live near the swimming pools of beautiful homes.
Yes. Well, this is a map made by the seer. Erla Stefansdóttir.
See her in that literally she could see the elves.
Yes, she could see those creatures.
And people, you know, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but people didn't make fun of her. They didn't...
I'm sure some people did. But also she was respected.
So we begin our walk.
We just have to cross the street here.
Hearing how when God paid a visit to Adam and Eve was so ashamed her children were dirty, she hid them in the mountains. God declared that what was hidden from him would remain hidden forever, the hidden people. Sippa's own uncle claimed an elf helped him tend the sheep at night when he was a child, gave him a rock as a gift. Then when the uncle grew old, he could no longer see the elf.
As an old man, he was looking for the rock he had given him, and he found it in his drawer. He held it in his hand, and the rock vanished. And he told us he was sure his friend was still around and had taken it. Okay, here we need to watch our step. We come this way.
This is enchanted. We are in a beautiful park, a volcanic field of black rock and dark green moss, birch trees and red winter berries. This place is supposedly silly with elves. We scramble up on a huge boulder called Elf Rock.
Okay.
You can come up here and see if anybody's home.
Okay.
Watch your step.
People come here to meditate and feel the hidden people energy and maybe ask their forgiveness.
If we cross them, if we try to break down their house or do something they don't like, they will put a spell on us.
Well, we heard of, you know, people trying to build roads.
Yes.
And people protested the building of the roads because it might go through a boulder.
Yeah. A man that studied at the university, he collected stories from older road workers.
Saying what?
Saying when the guys were making a new road, they would come to a rock or a hill and everything would go wrong. And in the end, they would go around the rock and then everything was okay. Around 1970, they were making a big road out of Reykjavik. And in the middle of the road, there was a big rock and things started to happen. Guys were falling down, hurting themselves. And people were saying, this is an elf rock and this is why everything is going wrong here. In the end, it was decided to have somebody come who negotiated with the elves. They moved out and the rock was moved to the side of the road and it's still there.
They do seem to be almost a conscience of the country when it comes to caring for the countryside.
Well, when I was growing up, my father had many stories from his family about the elves. And he taught us, his children, respect for nature. I think in many ways, it is. It's a great, great word to use. Conscious of the country. I like that.
All right, here we go. We're looking for elf living spaces.
Oh, yes. We will.
I think most Icelanders you meet, if you would ask them if they believe in elves, trolls, you know, hidden people, they would say, well, I can't outrule that they exist. And that is my answer.
That's Iceland's young, progressive Minister of the Environment, Gudmundur Gudbrandsson, the son of farmers who went to school in the U.S.,
I was telling my classmates, especially from the US, the elves and trolls in Iceland and the hidden people, I could read from their eyes and their expressions, he's crazy, he's so crazy. Mm-hmm. Until I met a student from Hawaii and she was like, yeah, of course. Yeah, no, I understand. We have those two volcanic islands. Is there a connection there? I ask myself. So what is it in our environment that makes us be more likely to believe in hidden people?
To him, it's the rock formations. As a child, he was told they were trolls, frozen into contorted positions when the sun hit them.
And you know, we can point at something in the landscape that is sort of a proof.
Personally, I don't think that has nothing to do with it. It only has to do with when this is accepted, which is still in Iceland, then everybody dare to talk about their experiences. That's why so many believe in elves.
That's Professor Magnus Skarphéðinsson at the Elf School in Reykjavik. Actually, Magnus's delightfully cluttered apartment, books and elf figurines piled high. We've pulled up chairs in the small parlor with five students from around the world as Magnus, who looks a little Santa-like himself, tells stories and takes questions.
We have hundreds, we have thousands of such stories. We collect them. We store them in special files.
The climate change and the elves connected, or at least the disappearing of the elves.
That's right. I met more than 900 Icelanders and 500 foreigners from 40 countries that have seen elves. 65 or 70 have met them regularly. The hidden people and the elves is always asking them, humans, why do you pollute so much? You have to stop this global warming and stop this pollution. You will kill yourself and you will also kill us. You have to change.
When did this start, and why do you think here?
There's only one reason why we have the elves. That is because the Enlightenment that started in Europe in 1600, which was a very good movement, changed the world more than word can express, but it has price. It killed faith in the world, cleaned out all myth and mythology. And the Enlightenment never came to Iceland. That's why we still have the elves.
Yeah, I think you have to ask your First Nations about that.
That's Tina Bucher from Germany. You think that in the American Indian, the indigenous people probably had some of the same beliefs that were wiped out.
Yeah, I think spirits like everywhere in the world.
Can I just ask, does everybody in this room who's at the class here now, are you here now because you also have a belief in elves or you wanted to find out more?
So I believe and I know that they exist.
I just wanted to know if I could find them myself one day.
Yeah, I think there is a connection with nature.
I'm very interested in myths and legends in Ireland.
That's Patricia McAteer, before that her husband John from Ireland. We also heard from a woman named Sunshine from New York. But John and Patricia from Ireland actually claim sightings.
Mm-hmm. Mine was in Donegal, in a very sacred site called Ungreenom. And the elf was halfway up the mountain, almost like the age of about a 14-year-old, but much older in features. Did have pointy ears and was in the expected green-brown outfit. Was very wary and cautious of me.
Are you sure that...
Absolutely positive. Yeah. It was an elf. Absolutely and utterly positive. And he just went like that.
Professor, what do you say to people who are going to hear this and just think you are all out of your minds?
Yes. But the most reason why 54% believe in elves is all Icelanders know some witnesses. Their grandma or grandpa or parent, when they tell you their elf experience, they are very sincere. This happened to me. And that's why people dare to talk about that experience. This is accepted part of the culture.
Elves are wonderful creatures, and we take them seriously.
That is Siggi Hilmarsson. In Iceland, he taught us to bake bread in hot volcanic springs. We want to leave you with his thoughts on elves.
If we come across a huge rock, we sometimes get a special person that speaks to the elves and get, permission.
You're smiling, but you're serious.
Yeah, it's a smiling, serious thing. There is a song that you should listen to. The lyrics go like, "Are elves perhaps men? Eru álvar kannski menn? Eru álvar kannski menn?" We smile, but we take it seriously.
A story from our 2019 visit to Iceland, our Christmas gift to you. And on this day, keep an eye out. You never know what you might see.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
5 years ago, when Emily McDowell was about 40 years old, she started to feel different. Anxiety, insomnia, migraine headaches. McDowell's doctor told her she was experiencing something she'd never heard before, puberty in reverse, also known as perimenopause. In layman's terms, that means around menopause, the time in which a woman's body makes the natural transition to menopause, marking the end of the reproductive years. And it's so much more than hot flashes.
I had an image in my head of like a angry lady. When I was growing up, you heard about it was mostly from the perspective of like unfunny male comedians comparing it to PMS.
So Emily McDowell started talking about it on Instagram, and thousands of women were also like, "Hey, I'm going through the same thing." Many of them said they felt their doctors were dismissing their symptoms and no one else in their lives were actually talking about it. So McDowell, who is an artist by trade, decided to put words to what she and millions of others experience by creating perimenopausal greeting cards. They offer uplifting and hilarious messages to women going through the change.
To have the knowledge that this is normal and that this is something that happens to everybody born female is so important, because so much of the fear and the confusion comes from feeling like you're alone in it and feeling like something's happening to me. Am I making this up? Am I crazy? And knowing, no, you're not.
McDowell has used greeting cards as a way to help normalize things we all go through, like grief, cancer, even the pandemic. And right now, she's thinking about how hard we can sometimes be on ourselves, especially during the holidays. Her new motto this year is, hey, it's okay to adjust our expectations, which means even a greeting card maker like herself has yet to send out holiday cards this year. And as of a few days ago, the McDowell family still hadn't bought a Christmas tree.
I'm applying that thought of like, just skip it to so much right now. And I'm kind of moving through life, like doing the bare minimum and really taking care of myself, like going for walks, and I am getting extra sleep, and I am having long phone calls with my friends, and I'm doing things that care for myself and that care for others in a way that feels nourishing.
We'll have links to Emily McDowell's art, which looks at ways to express empathy for ourselves and those we love. You can check those out at hereandnow.org.
And with just a little time left, Tanya and I wanted to send a shout out to a city that means a lot to both of us, and that is Detroit, Michigan. Christmas spirit is in full swing in my favorite city in the world, and it just makes me nostalgic for the time that I spent there. The best city ever.
It really is one of the best cities ever. It's an underrated city. I'm always like their poster child for it being an amazing city. And this is the time of year where it's the best to be there. You know why? Because I feel like it's not really Christmas if there is no snow and cold weather. Being here in LA, I'm really missing it.
Oh, yeah. And so much to do. Ice skating right in the center of downtown. Christmas lights along Lakeshore. I mean, Detroit's pretty awesome. People don't realize.
Yeah, and as you know, what they say, it is so cold in the D. An endearing thing. If you're on social media, you've likely found yourself humming a tune that you don't know the name of. Maybe a song from underneath one of those dance challenges. And it likely came from a TikTok video. Those earworms have turned into real dollars for artists. TikTok has had a major impact on the music industry this year, launching new artists and bringing forgotten songs out of obscurity. TikTok's end-of-the-year music report shows that more than 175 songs on the app in 2021 made it on the Billboard Hot 100 list. That's twice as many as 2020. We thought it would be fun to look back at some of the big TikTok hits of 2021, and here to help us do that is Dan Waitley, a media reporter at Insider who covers TikTok, YouTube, and the creator economy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes. So we can't start off this conversation without first talking about Olivia Rodrigo. At the beginning of the year, she was a little-known Disney star, and today she's one of the biggest pop stars around the world. And her debut album, Sour, received 7 Grammy nominations. And it all began with her first single, Driver's License. Let's listen. I guess you didn't mean what you wrote in that song about me. You said forever, now I drive alone past your street. Red lights, stop signs, I still see your face in the white cars. Front yards, can't drive past the places we used to go to, 'cause you know I still love you, babe. Oh, Dan, how has a viral success like Olivia Rodrigo, how does that happen on TikTok?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was hard to escape Driver's License in 2021. I think almost every other video at one point was, you know, someone making, you know, a kind of dramatic post about Driver's License. And it happens in a few different ways. So, first of all, it happens organically. So sometimes, you know, a song takes off when users start making videos about it. But there are also instances where record labels or artists will proactively promote a song on TikTok. And that involves maybe hiring an influencer to use their song or kind of paying to get it promoted on the app in other ways. So, you know, it certainly happens kind of serendipitously sometimes, but there's also very deliberate efforts within the music industry to make certain tracks do well.
There are also some other artists who have figured out how to work TikTok's magic to their advantage. One of them is Lil Nas X, whose career began with the success of Old Town Road on TikTok back in 2019. He once again went viral with his single Montero, Call Me By Your Name. Call me when you want, call me when you need,
Call me in the morning, I'll be on the way. Call me when you want, call me when you need. Call me out by your name, I'll be on the way. Like, yeah.
Doja Cat also had the second most catalog views of any artist in 2020. That is an accomplishment she repeated this year with several songs off her new album, Planet Her. Oh man, Dan, that's going to be in my head for the rest of the day. There's clearly some strategy here. You spoke with a number of power players in the music industry, including RCA Records, the label that works with Doja Cat. And you talked a little bit about how sometimes these record companies actually pay folks, influencers, to really promote their songs. But what are some of the ways, the other ways that artists and record labels are working with TikTok to promote their songs?
They also work directly with TikTok's internal music division. Everything from kind of signing licensing deals to understanding what an artist's priorities are. So if they have a new album coming out, TikTok can actually help them, you know, promote it within the app. They also, a lot of labels will work on kind of music contests to get users to make videos in mass. So everyone do the Doja Cat dance challenge or something like that.
We also saw some established artists like Taylor Swift join TikTok ahead of the re-release of her album, Red. And it didn't take long for that 10-minute version of her song, All Too Well, to go viral on the platform. Dan, Taylor Swift is an established artist. She has a massive fan base. She doesn't really need TikTok to build attention. And yet we saw this big rollout on the platform. Can you explain why? I mean, does TikTok's success do something different for artists as opposed to the traditional modes of like radio?
It does. So it's tough to not be on TikTok if you're a music artist at this point. And you're totally right that Taylor Swift has her own kind of universe and platform. She doesn't necessarily need any individual app to get noticed, but you know, she's very savvy about where the kind of next generation of listeners are discovering music, and right now that's TikTok. It's also YouTube and Instagram and other platforms, but TikTok is really like a kind of central place for people to hear a song for the first time.
Well, there are of course the success stories. Not everyone though who makes music goes viral on TikTok. How are independent artists and those signed to smaller labels faring?
Part of what has helped independent artists succeed on TikTok is kind of the randomness of its algorithm. So, you know, it's a bit of a lottery, I would say, but the opportunity is still there. I think it's harder now that there are a billion monthly active users to kind of get noticed on the app.
Well, one other way we see this is old music, music from the past. We see that it can become popular on TikTok, and I'm sure many artists are like, hey, how did my song from 1979 end up back on the charts? And oftentimes it's because of TikTok. There's one example of this with the Bee Gees, More Than a Woman. All right, Dan, this is now going to replace Doja Cat's song in my head for the rest of the day. But what's bringing these songs back? Are users organically rediscovering these classics? Or is it kind of like a mix of what you're saying? Someone does a video with This Is the Underbed and it goes viral.
Yeah, so the Bee Gees example is actually interesting because that was remixed by kind of a contemporary artist, a current artist. And so that helped it kind of get a boost. But legacy songs, catalog songs are completely in play now on TikTok, and that really has changed how you know, labels, record label execs think about promoting music, because it used to be primarily you would focus on your new tracks, right? New releases, artists that are kind of currently in pop culture, but you have the Bee Gees or you have Fleetwood Mac kind of suddenly reemerging, and those tend to happen kind of by chance. So someone does just like a really great video using a song, and suddenly everyone wants to repeat whatever they did, and it spreads, and suddenly you have, you know, over a million views on that song.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking a lot about what TikTok does for creators, but what does this mean for TikTok ultimately? It is an app where we watch videos and we can create videos, but does this signal that the company is growing and maybe morphing into something else in the future?
It's a great question. I think, look, TikTok is very aware of its kind of current role in the broader music industry. It realizes it has a lot of power. Its parent company, ByteDance, has been testing the waters with a music streaming service outside of the U.S. and kind of other markets, which, you know, is probably pretty scary for the other kind of major streaming platforms as they see that TikTok is currently kind of the hub for music discovery. If it also becomes the main place to listen to full songs, I mean, I think that's a real threat.
That's Dan Waitley, a media reporter at Insider covering TikTok, YouTube, and the creator economy. Before we let you go, what is a piece of music on TikTok this year that you'll keep on your playlist?
Oh, man, putting me on the spot. I mean, I love the Bee Gees More Than a Woman. That's also been stuck in my head for weeks probably. So, yeah, that's a great one.
That is a great one. Dan Waitley, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
In Colorado, at least 80 mobile home parks have gone up for sale in the last year, and a growing movement hopes to give residents more power over what happens next. In the city of Leadville, southwest of Denver, an unusual deal was made that could change the fate of the community. Colorado Public Radio's Andrew Kenny has more.
Cecia Santien's boots crunched through the snow on a stormy day. She's giving a tour of the mobile home community where she lives, an assortment of about 30 blue, green, and brown homes in this high mountain town.
Okay, pues este es la pequeña comunidad por la que estamos trabajando.
She and her neighbors live only two blocks from Leadville's famous historic Main Street. With lot rents that run about $400, it's one of the most affordable spots in town. But that convenient location has turned recently into a source of worry. Just across the street, construction crews are working on dozens of new homes that could retail for more than $500,000. When Santian and her husband saw the construction site, they wondered, would their own land be sold and redeveloped too? And they feared that was happening when a man came knocking at their doors this year. He was handing out flyers for a meeting. Santian and her husband decided not to attend. A lot of their neighbors were uneasy, too. The residents of this unnamed community are almost entirely Spanish-speaking. They travel far and wide for jobs in construction and cleaning. Most have lived here for years or decades because there's nothing like it for miles around.
La comunidad de Leldio en los últimos años.
That's another neighbor, Esther Soto, explaining that a boom of out-of-state investment has left few options for people who don't have good credit or immigration status or money. The residents soon learned that their fears were only partially right. The landlord did want to sell, but he wanted to sell to the residents.
I guess I'm a little unique.
That's Matthew Bransfield. He bought the place in 2019 for $1 million with the backing of his small Denver-based investment group. The draw for these investments is that landlords can collect steady rent without a lot of obligation.
It's really minimal compared to the upkeep and maintenance of other asset classes.
He says mobile home parks can return up to 12% of the original investment every year. That's attracted a lot of interest from venture capital funds and Wall Street investors, which means Bransfield has had a lot of competition as he's tried to acquire new parks. So he decided to quit the business. He could sell the Leadville Park to one of those investors, but he had heard about a growing movement. He decided to approach a regional nonprofit and see if he could sell it to the tenants instead.
And it just feels like something good that we can do inside of the community and inside of an asset class that's been, in many cases, historically predatory upon the end tenant.
The push for resident-owned communities has grown to include hundreds of mobile home parks across the country since the 1980s. But it's pretty new in Colorado. The community in Leadville would only be the sixth out of more than 700 registered mobile home parks in this state to be purchased by residents. In the resident-owned model, communities take out relatively low-interest loans to cover the cost of purchases. Residents often face steep initial rent hikes under this model. They'll be on the hook for future capital needs like sewer repairs, and they'll have to agree never to sell or redevelop the park, even though it's on a lucrative piece of land. But over a few meetings, those doubts turn to,
okay, now it's more of a sense of like, yes, this is going to happen. We might be able to own our community.
That's Eudelia Contreras, an organizer with the local nonprofit Lake County Build a Generation, which is helping residents through the process. If the purchase goes through, it would be a relatively rare victory for residents in Colorado. A new law is supposed to give all residents a chance to bid on their park before it's sold, but advocates say that success often hinges on having a cooperative landlord who actually wants to sell to residents instead of taking an easier deal with a big company. Some landlords have ignored or rebuffed offers, helping to defeat one effort in Fort Collins, a few hours north of Denver. To have more victory, advocates say they need more funding, more help from local governments, and stronger relationships with landlords and residents before the properties go up for sale. But in Leadville, hopes are running high for now.
Right now, the engineers are scheduling their inspections of the property within the next few weeks here. Our goal is to hopefully close by the end of this year.
A study by researchers at the University of New Hampshire gives reason for some optimism. They found that resident-owned communities tended to offer below-market rents, even while they gained in property value. And the national nonprofit that supports them says that none have failed financially. Josefina Chirez has seen the park sold three times in her 30 years there. She hopes this will be the last time. She and her neighbors have already picked a new name.
Ah, Cooperativa Nueva Unión, sí es cierto.
The Cooperative New Union. Its president, Esther Soto, thinks it could be the beginning of something much bigger. At their home on the north side of the park, Cecia Santian and her husband say they're ready.
Lo texturamos todo liso, lo pintamos.
In the last few months, as they gained faith in the idea of a purchase, they started replacing the floors and taking down the popcorn ceilings of their home. They figure that they're going to be here for a long time. For Here and Now, I'm Andrew Kenny.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles. This is Here and Now.